This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. In 1961, Frida Kelly was a teenager in Liverpool, England, working as a typist by day and frequenting Beatles concerts by night. At the age of 17, Frida got what might have been the best job in the world. She was hired as the Beatles' secretary. She was working for him for 11 years, including after the band broke up. Oh, the story she could have told. But you know she never did. Frida Kelly has kept the confidence of the Beatles for over half a century, and she has remained well out of the spotlight. Today she's still working in Liverpool, neither rich nor famous, but apparently very happy. Well, now her story is out. A new documentary called Good Old Frida takes a look at the life of Frida Kelly and her time working with the Beatles. The film's going to play at 6 o'clock Saturday, November 2nd. At the Center for Documentary Studies in Durham, Ryan White is the director of that documentary, Good Old Frida, and he is here with us on the State of Things. Ryan White, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. Tell us about Frida Kelly. How did she land that job?
So Frida was a working secretary in Liverpool when she was 16 years old and was invited during lunch one time to go to the Cavern Club, which was one of the main music clubs in Liverpool, and went over to the Cavern Club for her lunch, and the Beatles were playing there, and she became addicted and went to see them 190 times over the next few months and became a good friend of the Beatles. This was well before they were, you know, the Beatles and very famous. And so when they were starting to break and Brian Epstein, their manager, needed a secretary, he went to her, and she lasted with them for 11 years.
And it's an interesting story because you say 16, 17 years old, she's hanging out with these guys who look pretty scruffy. Her father didn't like the idea at all, right?
No. Her father is sort of the antagonist in our movie. He didn't like the way the Beatles looked. They used to drop her off at home because Paul and George had cars. They used to drive her home after shows, and he didn't want her hanging out with them. And actually, you know, her father passed away in 1968 while the Beatles were still going. And Frida will say her father never came around, even though she was working for the most famous band in the world. Even in 1968, he wasn't a fan of the Beatles.
It's an incredible story, too, because she starts out when they were not so popular, right? And she's heading up their fan club, which was not a lot of work early on. And then it got increasingly intense as their fame became greater and greater. Tell us about the sort of cascade and how Frida begins to realize that these guys are going to be pretty darn big.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as we always say, there was no predecessor for Beatlemania. You know, they were four ordinary boys to her and to Brian Epstein at the time, very talented, but very ordinary. So no one really saw what was coming. And one of the stories in our film actually is that Frida began the fan club for the Beatles, and she began by putting her home address on, as the official fan club address. And so as the Beatles started to break in 62 and especially 63, her own home started getting flooded with fan mail to the point where the postal vans were rolling up every morning and pulling out baskets and baskets and baskets of fan mail. And so her father finally put a stop to it and told her that it was crazy. And that's when they actually officially moved the Beatles fan club under the umbrella of NEMS, which was Brian Epstein's organization. But yeah, I mean, Frida was at the center of the storm throughout Beatlemania. You know, the fan mail only increased through 63, 64, 65. And, you know, this was the pre-internet days where, you know, everything was very old school and handwritten. And Frida went to very, very great lengths to keep those fans happy, writing handwritten letters, sending them things that I think would be unheard of now in the pop music culture. You know, she used to follow the Beatles to the barber and sweep up their hair and send out individual strands of hair to girls, or she would steal their shirts when she was at their homes and would cut up pieces of their shirt and send it out to girls. And so I think because Frida was a fan herself, first and foremost, she went to extremely great lengths to keep these fans happy. And I think it's probably, you know, a snapshot in time to an era that doesn't exist anymore and probably never will, the handheld attention that Beatle fans got.
It really is amazing to think about this person who is so attentive to fans. And the more she talks, the more you realize that she couldn't disappoint them. And the Beatles were themselves, the four of them were very close, it seemed to me, to Frida. They liked her a lot and helped her out a lot. They signed the autographs. They'd give her the shirt. And at one point, Ringo gives her a pillowcase that she asked for because one fan wanted it, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was a good friend of the Beatles before they were famous, and part of her job was also she was sort of the link between the Beatles and their individual families, especially when Beatlemania struck and the Beatles were traveling all over England and then all over the world. Frida was sort of the connector to their families, so she was extremely close with all of the Beatle parents. I think she's probably, you know, the leading authority on all the Beatles families because she spent so much time with all of them. And so, yeah, one story in the film is that she used to pop in and out of their houses all the time, and the Beatles were completely participatory in this stuff. She says they really enjoyed signing things and really enjoyed the fame that was coming. And one time went over to Ringo's house and took him a pillowcase that a girl had sent in and made him sleep on it, made sure his mom made sure that yeah. he slept on it. Yeah. And he brought it in the next day and slept on it. And she says, you know, that girl probably never believed her that Ringo actually slept on that pillowcase, but he did.
And you're right. It was his, according to the story in your film, it was his mom who really kind of enforced that. Very close to Ringo's mom. By the way, one of the cool things about this is that she keeps referring to Ringo as Richie. Don't you love Richie, I yeah. love that. I mean, he's Richie to her. But also deeply loyal and absolutely was in this position. I mean, if clearly, you know, they weren't big when she started, but they got big and she could figure out how she could commodify them and make a killing. And she never told tales. She was offered, you know, tabloids said, hey, if you just slip us some information, we'll slip you an envelope. Nobody has to know. She turned it all down. Fiercely loyal, wasn't she?
Yeah, and still is. You know, probably the number one question I get asked is, why is Frida still a working secretary? Why hasn't she been better taken care of by the Beatles or the organization? And I always say, Frida's had so many opportunities in her own right throughout her life to cash in on the Beatles that she's never taken advantage of. You know, she's had many offers over the last 50 years to write tell-all books, to make millions, and she declined all those offers. She also closed down the Beatles' offices, so she left with truckloads of extremely expensive Beatles memorabilia, autographs, photographs, some of the most rare things that auctioneers would be dying to get their hands on. And instead of selling any of it, she gave it away all over the years to fans and still gives away what she has. And so, you know, I think there's an extreme deep-seated loyalty to the Beatles because they were her friends. And I think she was never going to betray that while she was with them or in the 40 years after that.
There's a nice moment in the film where she takes you up to the attic and discovers mm-hmm. that she did still have a few pieces left. Let's listen to that clip.
I could have been a very, very wealthy woman, probably a millionaireess, if I'd have kept everything. I had loads of autographs, photographs, all the fan club stuff, Apple stuff, fan club records. But over a period of time, I gave it all away. But I don't regret that, you know, because I know when I gave the majority of the stuff away, I gave it in 1974, and I actually handed the stuff to Beatle fans myself, so I knew the Beatle fans got all the fan club stuff that was left. I've got these four boxes anyway. I didn't even think I had four boxes.
There she is, good old Frida. The film is produced by Ryan White, who is the director, and it will play at 6 o'clock Saturday, November 2nd at the Center for Documentary Studies. Ryan, why did she decide to do this film now and tell her story after all these years?
Yeah, so as I said, I mean, she's had many offers over the last 50 years to do it and always declined. And I think what happened now in her life, and we explore this in depth in the film, but I think she's reached that age where she feels it's important to leave this as a legacy for her family. Frida had two children. One of them passed away about 10 years ago, her son, and he was the one who always asked her to tell the Beatles stories, even just to him privately. And she says she just never really took the time. And I think she has this very deep-seated regret that he never knew, you know, her 11 years of stories with the Beatles. And so now she has a grandson. Her daughter had a baby. He's 2 years old now. And when he came along, I think she thought, I'm not going to lose out on sharing this with my family twice. And so, you know, that's the real reason she did this. She could have made a lot more money writing a tell-all book or doing some sort of larger film. But she really sees this as a family film. She would have been very happy if I had just printed her one DVD and she could hand it to her grandson and he could watch it when he's old enough to understand it. The idea that this has blown up into a full-fledged film baffles her and kind of blows her mind. But so she did it. She did it for her family. It comes from real, honest, genuine reasons.
Well, and she didn't tell her son those stories. She didn't tell anybody those stories. Not that she would walk away from it or pretend she wasn't, but people would comment. You know, now and then she'd see something on TV and it would remind her, and she'd say a little something and say, "My goodness, Rita, why don't you tell us more about your life with the Beatles?" And then that's when she'd say, "Well, you know, it's none of your business. That's gone." It's incredible. One moment in the film, though, that I thought was really lovely when she cracked just a little bit, and when we almost got an insight into or almost got the story we were all wishing to hear. I want to play that clip right now.
Did you go out with any of them?
No.
Okay.
Pass.
No stories there?
Oh, there is stories, but I don't want anybody's hair falling out or turning curly. That's personal.
There we go. That's Frida Kelly, the Beatles secretary and president of their fan club. Yeah, answering like 8,000 letters a day, right? And she was really writing the some kind of, and also a newsletter that she wrote regularly to keep everybody or the fans up to date, right?
Right, yeah, there was something back then called the Beatles Monthly, because there was no internet and there was no way to keep fans immediately on top of Beatles news. She had to do it in very old school ways. And so they had this magazine called the Beatles Monthly that came out monthly, obviously. And Frida wrote the newsletter in it. It was basically the way that she would impart, as she calls it, little gossipy snippets about the Beatles' lives. And I think gossipy would not be the word people would use now, you know, but she would let people know when they were having kids or when they'd gotten pets or when they were getting married or, you know, who went to the dentist, you know, and was still extremely protective of their privacy, even in those newsletters. And so for hardcore Beatles fans, those Beatles monthlies are kind of relics now, and Frida's newsletter was always sort of the staple that was in them. So we use that in a part of our film to kind of retrace Beatles history, because she wrote one every month basically throughout the Beatles' entire decade.
Well, here's a sample.
Dear Beatle people, quite a lot of letters sent in discussed John, Cynthia and Yoko Ono. At least as many members have written about Paul and Jane. Everyone has dozens of questions to ask, and many of you have only been too ready to put forward your opinions. Here at the fan club, we believe that the Beatles deserve their separate and individual private lives, which should remain their business and no other people's. I'm sure both John and Paul will work out their problems in their own ways, and I think they should be allowed to do so without the help or hindrance from millions of Beatle people. To offer now, Frida Kelly.
There we go. She's doing this by herself, right? There's no real school for fan club presidents in 1963, 64 when she's doing this. And she's a 17-year-old girl, right? How did she figure all this out?
Yeah, I mean, there was no model for it. She jokes that she signed up for a bunch of fan clubs when she started working for the Beatles because she didn't even really know how to run one. But I think in many ways, Frida sort of created that model on how fan clubs are run even to this day. I mean, it wasn't her alone, obviously. I mean, she worked for Brian Epstein, and then later on they had, you know, press officers, and that inner circle got larger. But for the most part, it was a 17-year-old girl who was at the center of the storm. I mean, she retired when she was 27, so she was quite young working for the Beatles the entire time. And so I think, you know, Frida has never sought recognition or credit for the job that she did for the Beatles. It's just not important to her. But I think in many ways she deserves a lot of credit for that work that she did for the Beatles, but also kind of devising that model that still works today.
Well, I think any question about her importance to the Beatles and to Brian Epstein is erased when you hear the story of what happened when the Beatles were going to move to London, and she was pretty excited about going with them, and then she went home and told her father. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so the Beatles moved to London in 1964, I think it was. They moved their organization from Liverpool to London, and Frida was supposed to go with them because she was their top girl, and her father wouldn't let her go. And she was of age. She could have gone, but he was quite sick at the time, and Frida was extremely close with her father as well. And so she handed in her notice. She was the first person that ever tried to quit working for the Beatles and went into Brian Epstein's office and let him know that she was leaving. And he was very upset and didn't want her to leave, didn't think it was going to be good for the organization. So he actually met with Frida's father privately and tried to talk him into it, and her father wouldn't go for it. But Brian Epstein and the Beatles and her father were able eventually to hatch a plan that Frida would visit London a couple times a month and that she would hold down fort in Liverpool. So the fan club continued to be run from Liverpool, and Frida worked from there.
And she makes it very clear that while her father objected, she could have gone, and she chose her father. So again, this question of loyalty, and which loyalty? I mean, you're the Beatles' secretary. Now they are big, and your dad needs you, so you're staying in Liverpool, and that means you were willing to quit. Beatles wouldn't let her go. Brian Epstein wouldn't let her go. Your story, too, does focus on her and not so much on the story of the Beatles. It's underlying the whole thing. How did you come to do this story to begin with?
So my uncle was in a band called the Mersey Beats, which were a contemporary band of the Beatles in the 1960s. They were on the Cavern scene with the Beatles and quite famous in England. And so I've grown up around a generation of people that come from that 1960s Liverpool music scene. My uncle was in the Mersey Beats. My aunt worked for Frida in the Beatles fan club. And so Frida's part of their group of friends, and I knew her growing up from, you know, family weddings or Christmases and events like that. She really is that private about her past. I had no idea she was the Beatles secretary. I, you know, thought she was my aunt's friend who was a working secretary at a law firm in Liverpool and very charming to sit next to at wedding receptions, but I didn't know there was a backstory there. And Frida approached me about 3 years ago about doing the film with her. I always joke that I'm lucky to be the only documentary filmmaker in the family that she trusted, at least. So right. she turned to me to do it. And, you know, I didn't know what that meant at first. I didn't know, you know, she didn't come to me and say I was the Beatles secretary. And I didn't know when people started telling me that she was the Beatles secretary, you know, that meant 11 years, or that meant that she was the, you know, one of the only survivors from the inner circle, or the only one who never went down on the record. So when we began having the conversations about making the film, I actually kind of thought I was doing her a favor and would help her record her stories and hand them over to her family. But it became immediately clear to me once we started having these conversations and shooting, and especially after I started doing research and talking to other people, that this could be more than a family film. Not that there's anything wrong with a family film, but that there might be a much bigger audience out there for it.
There is, Ryan. Great film. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Frank.
Ryan White is the director of the documentary film Good Old Frida, screened Saturday, November 2nd at the Center for Documentary Studies, part of the Duke Entertainment Media and Arts Network Weekend. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.
I love you more.